Very good. So now I want to just go over this sort of basic ground. I don't want to spend too long on it, and I tend to speak too much. So I'll make it short and sweet for a bit of luck. First thing is to be very clear about what the Buddha means by right awareness. Awareness is awareness, and the bank robber's aware, but it's not the path. So we have to go back to really to define what the Buddha means by this right awareness. So it's good just to recall his life story, just very quickly, the skeleton of it. A point in his life is becomes tired of the pleasures of life. So he belongs to what we would call the aristocracy. He's the ruling caste, he's the warrior caste. And I wouldn't have thought he had much to do, really. Sort of hang about, fire a few arrows, you know, sort of, listen to a bit of music. An easier life that we sort of touch upon when we go on holiday, sort of, you know. You don't get this feeling that you have to do anything in particular. So that's the first thing, he gets tired of those pleasures. But the next is a more existential crisis. You know, he wakes up to the fact of sickness, aging and death, which happens to a lot of people in their middle, late 20s, you know, when youth has finally disappeared. And they realise that ahead of them is horror. So it's a case of him waking up to that and being so shaken by it that he's, you know, he's off, he wants to go and spend some time with these ascetics. Now, when he finds his ascetics, he gets two teachers who teach him how to develop the ecstasies, the absorptions, as we call them. The thing about these practices, which you find in all religions, through prayer, through mantra, and all that sort of stuff, is that you create your own inner bliss without any need for anything outside you. You know? No need for DVDs, Facebook, anything like that. It's amazing. You can just sit there, get into this state, and you're away. So you can imagine how you need, you know, you don't need that much food, you don't need a special dwelling place, because your dwelling, your happiness is within your own heart, you see. Now, the problem with that was whenever it came to an end, he just found himself back to being the miserable old, depressed, anxious Siddhartha Gautama. It hadn't really answered his question as to what was the end of, was there an end to this? Now, you have to put it in the perspective of the time. There was a general belief in rebirth, that one kept coming back to the same old thing. And that was one of those particular worries of the age. There were materialists, there were those who believed that, you know, when you die, that's the end of it. And he left those two teachers. He still thought the practice was good. I mean, it's part of the whole of teachings, but it hadn't actually answered his question. He then went into self-mortification practices. His elder contemporary was the Jain leader, Nigantha, who was a fearsome ascetic. And there were two philosophies. One was the materialist philosophy, which was basically, you know, get out of life the best you can. And that was really part of that jhana thing, the absorption thing, that at least you could, you know, you could just get the best out of life through these practices. The other side was that the idea was that there was an eternal soul, and that the soul was being weighed down or kept down by karma. Karma manifested as your body. Your body was a manifestation of your karma. And therefore, one had to let go of the body. So one way was to not feed its appetites. So there was a lot of fasting. To get away from society and any of the entertainments and things like that. To live a very simple life. And in the Jain religion, the saint is one who actually withdraws so much from life that he just starves himself to death. It's a complete letting go. Okay. The Buddha did all this. He said he could hold his stomach. He said he could hold his spine through his stomach. If you try that, you'll see how thin he was. And it didn't get him anywhere. He said he was just more suffering. So he left his five companions who thought he'd gone soft. And when he's by the roadside, we know the name of the woman, Sujata. She's coming along to offer something to a local deity. These little rice cakes, I think they were. You know, I prefer rice pudding, I always say that. So anyway, she offers this, she sees this wretch. And in the scripture, of course, he's glowing like a god, but I mean, it's impossible. He must have looked pretty wretched. So she gives him this food, and it revives him. And then there comes a memory, which is absolutely core to this whole definition of him as self-enlightened. He remembers the parts in childhood where he's watching his father doing a ploughing ceremony. And he realizes, on memory, that the mental state was in this very clear absorption state. But there was something extra. The extra was this sense of inquiry, like, what is my dad doing? And from that, the whole of his practice turns around on itself. So instead of seeking an escape from suffering, finding if there's another place, another way, right, he turns back into the suffering and asks, how does suffering arise in the first place? And it's with that inspiration that he sits under the tree. And such is his determination that he says he's going to sit there to crack this problem or die, you see. So I always say it's lucky for him and lucky for us. And he said it took him 6 hours, that's what he said. And what he discovers is the core problem, which he names as the delusion, and the delusion of who we actually are. And it was the process of desire that he pointed to as a psychological mechanism which creates the problem. And this desire is not a good translation for the word. It presumes that we are seeking happiness as human beings in the sensual world, and it's never going to deliver, if only on the grounds that it arises and passes away. And yet we keep doing it. We keep searching for this place of happiness in some way. Even when we know that it's going to end, we're still happy to let the ending be a suffering, because we enjoy at least having it. See? So a loving relationship, but we know all those come to an end. Even it comes with death. See? And yet we're prepared to devote ourselves to it. And it becomes a psychological dependency for our happiness. So he's pointing to that little specific problem within us, the psychological problem, as the core, direct cause of our suffering, you see. Deeper still, of course, it's to do with identity, it's to do with who we are, with discovering who we are. Now, just to go back a step, this awareness, you see, remember, goes back to a child. So if you put a child's face if you bring a child's face to mind as to how, when they see something they've never seen before, what happens to their face? They become completely absorbed, yeah? The eyes are completely still. They've never seen this little thing like a beetle before. And they watch it with an intensity, so that even if you shout at them, even if you pull them away, their head still stays still. And the jaw drops, see, the jaw drops because there's no thought. So that's why in the instructions you always relax the jaw. Yeah. So you get the fixation, the attention on the object, the jaw drops because there's no thought, they don't know what it is, there's a complete absorption of it. And when it's fully absorbed, the question arises, you know, like, what is it? Okay. So we have to go back to that level of attention, you see. And that's the whole process of our meditation. We're using just sensation, the sensation of the breath, to release this intuitive intelligence from its confusion with thought. Okay? That's the process. And once it begins to release itself from conceptual thinking, right, then it begins to see things in a much more clear, direct way. And why do we want to release ourselves from conceptual thinking, from thoughts, images, and all that sort of stuff? Because they're history. And every time you look at something, you plonk your history onto it and distort your ability, rather, to see it as something new. So, for instance, just here, walking around, you might have looked at the trees and you'd have known it was a tree and you'd have seen a tree, but actually what you've seen is your image of a tree plonked onto that tree. You've not seen that tree as it is. To see that tree as it is, you've got to go up to it, you've got to look at the leaf. You know, you've got to get into hugging trees. You've got to get back to that direct contact with it through the sensual base. Otherwise, we just live in this world of make-believe. Right? Which works. I mean, we need it, of course, for our daily life. You can't be going around doing that all the time. But I mean, but we need to know that that's actually not seeing things as they really are. So to see things as they really are, we've got to go back to this direct perception. And we do that by bringing in the meditation, we bring that to our sense base, to our sense, to our the way we sense things, to our feelings, to our sensations in the body. Okay. So this right awareness that he's talking about, it's the ability to observe things without conceptual thinking. That's part of it. Okay. And we do that, remember, by always drawing ourselves to feeling sensations, because they are actual. They only happen in the present moment, and you can't imagine them. Yeah? Can you now imagine a pain in your knee? Okay? No matter how much you imagine it, you're not going to feel it. It has to come from the knee. Yeah? The next thing is to be clear about how to deal with everything that takes us away from that focus. So, just very quickly, you can divide them into two types. There are ones that create all this mental stuff, all the dreaming and the fantasizing and all that. And there are those which take us into oblivion, right? Sleep. Okay. So now, the technique is very simple. Okay? As soon as we wake up out of a fantasy or a dream or some exciting stuff that's going on, you know, how to save the world and all that, you note it, you see, you say, ah, right, see, so that's excitement, planning. I'm planning to do, there is planning going on, see? Or I'm worrying. And you come back into the body and see if you can actually get contact, that state of mind, a feeling within you, okay? And you just stay there with that. And again, you might use noting words just to keep yourself, keep the mind on it, worry and all that. And your attention is just on the feeling of it. And what you're doing is, you're allowing this heart turbulence to manifest, and in so doing, it's exhausting itself, and it's deconditioning itself. Now, you wouldn't do that if you didn't begin to realize that every time it escapes into a thought pattern, it's actually developing itself. See? If you want to make yourself really anxious, start worrying. Right? Just keep worrying all the time. You just wake up in the morning, you're full of it. See? But if you want to bring an end to anxiety and an end to depression, you've got to allow the heart to speak its truth to you, right? And of course, it's not pleasant for the most part. But also in the opposite too, feelings of romance, love, nostalgia, things that we sometimes enjoy, our daydreams, see? You have to note that too and come back to the original feeling and allow that to exhaust itself. So that, I mean, we can go into the more details about how to deal with specific states of mind, but that's your general technique, okay? To actually name, to be very clear about the attitude which is driving the mind, and then to find that attitude within yourself as a feeling state. If you can't, no problem, just go back to the breath, okay? Now, the other ones are... those types of things, by the way, are more like a whirlwind. They just shoot us out into all sorts of, you know, thinking. The other one is more like a whirlpool, sort of drags us down into the depths of oblivion. Now, oblivion's wonderful, because there's no suffering in oblivion. See? But unfortunately, you keep waking up. So this sleep, it's not as though we don't need sleep, see? We need sleep, that's not a problem. But we've overlaid that with a certain enjoyment of being asleep, a certain enjoyment of being subliminal, you know. So, for instance, when we feel a bit, just a bit fed up or something, so you launch yourself onto the couch and fall asleep, and you wake up and feel a bit better, see. And all the time we're using sleep to suppress, to push away, to keep away. Other times we enjoy, you know, like, Sunday morning, well done, you didn't do it this Sunday morning. You sort of wake up and you go for a cup of tea and you get back in the bed and you sort of dream. Keep on that little subliminal level. And every so often you might wake up to hear the birds and then you go back into it. Okay? And it's just finding this lovely place where you're not quite there and you are quite there. And it's just lovely. See? And of course it's a form of suicide. Right? You just want to get rid of yourself for a while. That's all. See? Now, unfortunately, that's not the path to liberation. So when it comes up in your meditation... Again, you have to allow it to express itself. The dullness in the head, the heaviness in the body. And you make that your object of meditation. So you wander about it, just feeling it, sensing it. See? all the time just allowing it to exhaust its energy. And it is an energy. It's an energy drawing you down, you see, rather than spacing you out. So that's one of our big hindrances. I haven't come across a meditator who hasn't had big problems with falling asleep. You know? It's just the way it is. In fact, one of the great teachers of the last century, Sun Lung Saidor, who attained full liberation, I think it was in 6 weeks, believe it or not. You can still see his preserved body. It hasn't corrupted. And when they asked him, why is it, you know, that people don't become liberated? So they're lazy. I think if we're truthful, we're lazy. So that's how we deal with these mental states that arise and pass away, both negative and positive. And the final thing is, we need to know what it is we are actually investigating. Right? We're not investigating just anything. We're investigating the three characteristics of existence, because these hold our delusions, our delusion about life. And these three characteristics relate to the idea of an eternal soul, or a self, or something absolutely permanent. So all the Buddha's saying is, if there is a soul, then it's permanent. I mean, that's the whole idea, it's eternal. And if it's eternal, it can't change. If it changes, it's something else. So there can't be any change within an eternal soul. Okay? So he says, well, investigate. What is there in your experience which doesn't change? Right? Not outward experience, in your inner experience. In your experience inward, your interior life. Is there anything there which is not changing? Okay? So if it is changing, well, it can't be a soul, that's all. It can't be the real, it can't be the ultimate. That's all he's saying. Secondly, he's saying the soul, if it's whole, entire, complete unto itself, must be in complete charge of itself. So if it's in complete charge of itself, it must be able to say, I'm going to be happy. That's it. It doesn't have to worry anymore. See? Because it's got to be in a complete state of happiness if it's to be an eternal soul, because it's in control of itself. Right? It was one of the definitions. So he says, well, have a look. What are you in control of? See? When you look at your body, what are you actually in control of? Sure, you can wave your arms about, you know, you can do all that sort of stuff, but can you stop it falling ill? Can you put more hair on your head? You know, if you really investigate your body, you see you have actually minimal control. When it comes to your emotional life, if you feel depressed, can you say, that's it, no more depression, that's it, I'm not having any more, that's it, finished. And that's it, that's the end of it. When it comes to your thought, I mean, that's the first thing that, especially those of you who are new to the meditation, that's the first thing that strikes people, most people, when they come to meditation, is how they have no control over their minds. They think they have because they're always entertaining it, but as soon as they want it to stop, it just won't. So, a matter of control. Can you control it? No. So those three things, is it permanent? Is there anything in our experience which is permanent? Can we establish a state of continuous happiness just by an act of will? And what sort of control? Do we have any control, real control, over this psychophysical organism? See? And that's what you're doing. That's all you're doing. You're looking at it from these three perspectives. And what it's undoing is the idea of who I am. Right? Now that doesn't take us into an annihilation. It doesn't take us into a nothingness. The Buddha's quite clear that there is something, inverted commas, which doesn't belong to this human form, right? And it's done by way of abstraction. So when you pull yourself back within yourself to look and feel and experience what's going on, you're constantly relocating your sense of identity. So that when you get inside yourself to find yourself being this observer, the feeler, see, it's very different, isn't it? Yeah, for those of you who've made it clear to yourself. So this process of abstraction, of pulling ourselves back to look at something, you see, is already a process of telling ourselves that what I'm experiencing isn't me, because I'm looking at it, I'm feeling it, it's an object. Right? So, we've talked about right awareness, this ability just to observe without thought. That's, the noting technique is one way in which you can limit thought, at least to a very simple, concrete object, concept. But you're always directing your attention to the body, to feeling. Yeah? Dealing with all the hindrances, as they're called, that come up, when they are something that takes us out into fantasies and dreams, to always come off it, to know what the attitude is that's driving it, to come back into the body, to feel it, to allow it to express itself. And if there's nothing there, you go back to the breath. And we're constantly guiding our attention to these three qualities. The fact that everything's impermanent, don't have control, and the process of desire, which is always trying to manipulate life to make it, to make us happy. It's always pushing something away, which it doesn't like, or trying to keep hold of and maintain something it does like. Yeah? So for fear that I've done nothing but confuse people, for those of you who are completely confused, if you hang about a bit, and I'll try and sort out any real confusion. And for the rest of us, if we do just a small walking meditation, say for half an hour again, you give the bell about 22, and then we'll come back for a short sit, and then there'll be a little walking period.